This is American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Each week on our program, of course, we choose some theme, bring you a variety of different kinds of stories on that theme. Today's show, Go Ask Your Father. Stories in which grown people seek answers from their own parents. And there are definitely certain answers that they would prefer to hear. And only sometimes do they get them. We arrived at Act 2 of our show. Act 2, My Favorite Martian. Paul Tuff tells the story.
This is a story about fathers and sons. And it is a story about communication with alien beings. It begins in the 1820s in Germany, where an astronomer and mathematician named Carl Friedrich Gauss was working as the director of the observatory in the town of Göttingen. After the death of first one wife and then a second, he began to spend every evening at the observatory, staring up through his telescope at the moon and the stars. Could it be, he wondered on those lonely nights, that far away on those distant specks of light, there was life? That people just like him were staring back through their own telescopes? Since the first moment that humans began dreaming of communicating with beings from other worlds, there have been two schools of thought on how best to go about it. One strategy is simply to observe, to look through telescopes, to listen to radio waves beaming down at us from space. The second is the active approach, to try to make contact ourselves. Gauss was the first person to suggest this latter approach, to say that it was we who should make contact with them. But how? This question is hard enough to answer today when we've got rocket ships and lasers and transistor radios. Gauss lived in an era of sextants and quill pens and leeches, none of which were very useful when it came to sending messages into space. So remember those limitations when I describe Gauss's two proposals, which might sound a little crude. Idea 1. Deploy an army of Russian lumberjacks to clear-cut thousands of square miles of Siberian forest in the precise shape of a right triangle, with huge markings along each side demonstrating the Pythagorean theorem. Idea 2. Dig a giant circular trench in the Sahara Desert, hundreds of miles in diameter, a perfect circle. Fill the trench with millions of gallons of kerosene. Wait until nightfall. And then set it on fire. But no one would spring for the kerosene, and so Gauss turned his attention back to non-Euclidean geometry, and for 150 years, no one had a single good idea. Then rocketry was invented, and Alan Shepard played golf on the moon, and all of a sudden the stars seemed closer than ever. Over at NASA, somebody had a brainstorm. Let's send the aliens a plaque. So in April 1973, Pioneer 11 was launched into space, and bolted onto it was a gold plaque. Maybe you've seen it. It's got a diagram of the solar system, some mathematical notations, and a drawing of a naked Caucasian woman and man, the man with his right hand raised at a 90-degree angle. 32 years later, this calling card is more than 4 billion miles from Earth, at the outer regions of our solar system. At some point, maybe tomorrow, maybe in 100 million years, someone will find Pioneer 11, or so the theory goes, and when they see the plaque, they will get the message. Greetings from planet Earth. This is what we look like. We are waving hello to you, and we are nude. In 1974, a year after the launch of Pioneer 11, an American astronomer named Frank Drake took the next step and sent a radio message into space, beamed from a giant radio telescope in Puerto Rico and aimed at a star cluster 21,000 light years away. The message was a series of ones and zeros that could be rearranged to form a diagram that showed a stick figure of a human. Innocuous enough, it would seem, and yet Drake's message drove the astronomy establishment completely crazy. International rules were drawn up, and since that day, no official radio message has ever been sent into space. But that doesn't mean that freelancers have quit trying to make contact on their own. They have not. And I can tell you this because one of them is my father. In the mid-1970s, my father, a mild-mannered university professor, concluded that there had to be more to life than commuting to work every day in his red Toyota Corolla and coming home every night to the quiet house on the sleepy street where his family was waiting for him. When he was about the age I am today, he started looking for something new, experimenting with LSD and open marriage and extrasensory perception, and listening over and over to Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, until finally, at about the time that Frank Drake was beaming his lonely message out into space, my father left his family behind and set off onto uncharted waters. From this description, my father might sound like a real Peter Fonda type, but in fact, he is anything but. He is a lover of office products, a man who thinks there is no decision, no matter how intimate and emotional, that cannot be made more effectively by drawing up a few lists and charts. At one point, a couple of years into his relationship with the woman he lived with after moving out of our house, he explained to me that he had come up with a system to eliminate the arguments that had begun to crop up between the two of them. If they had a disagreement, let's say about what they wanted to eat for dinner, they would each simply assign a number out of 10 to how strongly they felt about their preference. So their conversations included sentences like, "I'm a 7 on chicken." If his number was higher than hers, they'd have chicken. It might seem a little strange that a man who often has trouble making contact with the human beings around him has focused his energies on attempts to make contact with extraterrestrials. Strange, and at the same time, entirely fitting. Over the last few years, my father has been building his own giant flaming mode of kerosene. It is a page on the World Wide Web, and it is titled An Invitation to ETI, which stands for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This is how the page reads. Hello, ETI. We assume you are a highly advanced form of alien intelligence that originally came to Earth from some other place in the universe. We welcome you here. With respect and a spirit of friendship, we invite you to make contact. Feel free to use whatever form of communication you prefer. Email, fax, telephone, or a face-to-face conversation. It's easy to make fun of my father's project, but there is a logic to it, as unlikely as it sounds. A series of premises, each of which, taken alone, makes a certain sense. My father is right that there probably is life somewhere else in the universe. If other civilizations have developed, they probably are a lot more advanced than we are. He has a point when he says that there's no particular reason to assume that extraterrestrials would choose to communicate via radio signals. He can even be convincing when he says that these alien civilizations might instead have sent probes to our planet to monitor us and our communication media, including the internet. It's only when you put it all together, when you're actually sitting there, staring at the fax machine, waiting for the alien message to arrive, that the project suddenly seems a little dubious. In 5 years, my father has received about 60 messages through his website, and they were all pranks. Emails from smart Alex who thought it might be a good chuckle to impersonate an alien for a while. My father wrote back to all 60 of them, asking them for proof that they were really aliens. A couple of them kept the charade going for a few rounds, but eventually they all gave up and admitted they were only human. And then, late last year, a breakthrough. In November, my father received an email from a man named Harold, who seemed different than the jokers he usually heard from. Harold didn't claim to be an extraterrestrial. Instead, he said, he had obtained physical evidence of alien life, and he was offering to submit it to rigorous scientific testing. This evidence, he explained, was an alien probe, an energy field embedded in his body. He said that it emitted radio waves that could be detected by conventional instruments. My father was skeptical, but intrigued. He talked it over by email with the board of advisors he had assembled when he set up his website, and they decided that for the first time in the history of this project, they should put an alien claim to the test. Which is how I wound up driving out to a warehouse in New Jersey one winter morning to meet my father, who had flown down from Toronto for the day. I went because I wanted to see my father at work, because I thought it might give me a chance to connect to a part of his life that meant a lot to him, even if I didn't really understand just why. It also crossed my mind that if evidence of alien life was going to be found in suburban New Jersey, it wouldn't hurt to be the one guy there with the tape recorder.
Hey, Matt.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
When I first spotted my father, he looked a little weak and off balance. A couple of years ago, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and although it hasn't incapacitated him yet, he gets tired easily these days. It affects the way he talks, too. Sometimes he has to start a word 3 times before he finishes it once.
passport.
But he seemed glad to be there, catching up with two members of his advisory board who were also there for the test. One, named Paul, was an aerospace engineer, a bearded, energetic man who laughed a lot. The other, Richard, was tall and laconic, with long gray hair. He owned his own electronics firm, and it was his warehouse where we were going to run the test. It was nice to watch these guys interact with my dad. They looked up to him in a way. There was no sign of Harold, and for a while we thought maybe he wouldn't show up. But then he walked in and launched right into what sounded like a prepared speech.
But I have a little presentation. We have a chalkboard.
Harold was wearing baggy khaki pants and a white Oxford shirt that looked like it had been packed inside a duffel bag for a few days and then unfolded that morning. He had a kind of a 40s hat on, not a fedora, but a round hat, more casual, almost a fishing hat. He was clean-shaven and olive-skinned and animated. We all followed him into the library for his presentation.
And I'm going to do a demonstration with an RF detector to show that I am emitting radio frequencies. And exactly how, why, and where they're going, we will determine in the lab.
What he was saying, that he himself was emitting radio signals that were being monitored by an alien spaceship, didn't make a whole lot of sense. But there was something about the way he was talking. He acted just like a scientist. He had the lingo down, saying things like gigahertz and RF instead of radio frequency. And when he drew diagrams on the whiteboard, they looked convincing, full of vectors and arrows and numbers. Then he started unpacking his equipment.
At this point, I'll demonstrate the radio frequency.
He removed a Tupperware container from his knapsack and revealed a little device that looked like a computer circuit board, about 2 inches long. Then he put it into his mouth. It started to make noise.
What you have just seen is the activation of an RF detector by transmission from an electric field anomaly placed next to my vocal cords that it transmits back to the extraterrestrials.
I looked over at my father to try to figure out what he made of all this, but it was hard to tell just what he was thinking. And then it was time for the test. We all went downstairs to the lab, which was equipped with a huge radio wave detector. The idea was that it would measure the waves coming out of Harold's head. Richard talked him through it.
I guess the next step is for you to, is for you to go in the room.
Would you care to move your hat first, please?
Oh, sure.
You can't hear it on the tape, but this was a really awkward moment. When Harold took off his hat, we could see that he had lined the inside with tinfoil. A tinfoil hat. It's like a cliche, right? A shorthand term for crazy people who believe in aliens. I'd seen tinfoil hats in movies, but I didn't know they existed in real life.
I use that because sometimes the radio signals really affect me.
I can imagine. Do you have anything with you, any devices, anything made of metal?
Yes, I have some foil on my chest.
Okay. Just plain aluminum foil?
Yes,
plain foil. Is that all right? Bring it in there? If that's all it is,
yeah,
then,
that's all
it is. Okay. You don't have any artifacts?
No.
After the tinfoil thing, it wasn't such a big surprise when the lab's equipment failed to detect any radio waves being emitted from the probe in Harold's head. Harold was clearly upset that the experiment hadn't worked, and he made excuses and explained how maybe we needed more sensitive equipment. Paul and Richard, the scientists, seemed a bit ticked off by the whole experience. But my dad wasn't worked up at all. He thanked Harold, shook his hand, and gave him some money for his bus trip home. I wasn't quite sure what to feel. I was a little disappointed despite myself. I did feel like I'd shared some history with my father, even if it wasn't the Pulitzer Prize-winning kind. But I still didn't really understand just what it was that had brought us here. So after Harold left, I sat down with my father on an office couch just off the library, and I finally got a chance to ask him about some things I'd never really understood about his quest, including what seemed like an unavoidable question for anyone in the field of SETI, which is what insiders call the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Do you think people think of SETI as a joke sometimes?
Yeah, we call it the giggle factor in SETI. Sure.
And why do you think that is?
Haven't figured it out. I figured it myself, you know. I can't always keep a straight face when I tell people what I do.
Really?
Sure.
Well, how come?
Oh, it just is funny to be trying to make contact with another culture that we don't even know whether it exists or not.
Is there any other scientific field that is like that?
I can't think of one where the field hasn't even proved that its central phenomenon exists.
It's true when you look at it that way. Pretty dramatic.
It's a thing I sometimes forget about my dad. He doesn't have a lot of illusions about how likely it is that aliens will get in touch anytime soon. I think it's the reason why he didn't seem all that disappointed when Harold struck out in the lab. He's prepared to keep waiting. But I can't help feeling that there is something a little sad about any search for extraterrestrial intelligence, whether it's Carl Friedrich Gauss's or my father's. It seems like a quest born out of a great loneliness, out of the feeling that the life we see around us is not enough. It is a feeling, a longing, really, not that different than the way a frustrated husband and father might feel coming back to the same predictable home night after night. It is the feeling that there must be more than this.
You know, I thought that this was all the what's on Earth is all that there is in the universe. I'd be, I would feel that the universe was diminished somehow. I sometimes get accused of you know, expecting a savior, and I don't think I'm doing that. But it certainly comes close to religious belief, because you're dealing with something that's just so big, so overarching, so transcendent, that it's pretty close to what a lot of people call God. For me, the difference is that the ET could exist. I don't see how God could exist. It just sounds too fantastic.
Do you think this project is the most meaningful thing you've ever done?
Yes, I think it is. Yep. In fact, my shorthand nickname for it is The Ultimate Project, because it's probably my ultimate project. I've called it that from the start.
If I'm going to be honest with you, I should probably say that that's not the answer I wanted him to give. I wanted him to say, sure, maybe it's the most meaningful thing I've done professionally, but it doesn't compare to raising my family, to being a father. I think any child of an eccentric father feels two opposing things simultaneously. Mostly, you want him to stop embarrassing you. When he sends you an email, you want the subject header to be something normal, like Thanksgiving plans. You don't want subject headers like the one I received from my father the other day. What if our galaxy is populated by super smart machines? But at the same time, the thought of my dad dismantling his website and giving up his dream feels like a terrible loss. Even if my father's project doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, even if it sometimes feels more like prayer than like science, I want him to keep looking. It makes him seem a little less alien, oddly enough, and a little more human.
Potap is one of the original contributing editors to This American Life. He's now an editor at the New York Times Magazine. He first read a version of his story on stage at the Little Grey Books lecture series in New York. His father's website, if you're hearing my voice and you come from another planet, or you know somebody who does, sign in please, www.ieti, that's for Invitation to Extraterrestrial Intelligence.org. Well, our program is produced today by Diane Cook and myself, with Alex Bloomberg, Wendy Dorr, Jane Felta, Sarah Koenig, and Lisa Pollack. Our senior producer is Julie Snyder. Elizabeth Meister runs our website. Production help from Todd Bachman, Laura Bellis, Kevin Clark, Seth Lind, and Sativa January. Special thanks today to Elizabeth Carruthers, Cliff Dirksen, Gerald Davis, Elaine Schmidt, Jonathan Goldstein, and Julianne Hill. Our website, www.thisamericanlife.org, where you can listen to our programs for absolutely free, 24 hours a day, or buy CDs of them. Or, you know, you can download today's program and our archives at audible.com/thisamericanlife. This American Life is distributed by Public Radio International. This American Life is made possible by Volkswagen of America and the Volkswagen Jetta, reminding listeners that safe can happen anytime, anywhere. Volkswagen Jetta, safe happens. WBEZ Management Oversight for our program by Mr. Tori Malatia, who explains his theory about how to run a radio station this way.
But I would just turn everything on, you know, turn knobs and hear kinds of whoa, whoa, whoa sounds, you know.
I'm Ira Glass, back next week with more stories of This American Life.
We are your friends.
PRI, Public Radio International.